This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, hello, welcome along. Thank you for listening to a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. This is the show where we screech across the universe, taking a look at all the baffling and beastly science that's along the way. Today, we chat about a fruit that probably shouldn't be one of your five a day because it can kill you. Also, we'll get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system and hear from Professor Pulsar in Deep Space High. And we'll chat to a science expert all about how we can help the brand new species that are coming to live in the oceans as they get warmer all around the UK. So that's on the way after we get some of your gadget questions answered in a brand new episode of Techno Mum.
Techno Mum, engineering explorers.
This app is so addictive. It was free too. Pretty simple really, just matching frogs. I wonder how they made the game. Can't have been that difficult.
Shouldn't you be tidying your room?
Just finishing this level. So Mum, here's a question for you. A games programmer's also engineers.
Of course, they're software engineers. Software is the name for the computer programs which contain the instructions to run apps, games, applications, even machinery.
I suppose there are computers in pretty much everything these days.
That's right. Not just inside a PC. There will be computer programs inside kitchen appliances, like washing machines, inside the cars we drive, not to mention electronic toys and smartwatches. And they're used in helping manufacture all these things too, whether a car on a production line or a plastic drinking bottle.
But how do software engineers make a program? It's not like building a house where you've got bricks and cement to work with.
Software has its own building blocks, computer code. Just like there are hundreds of different languages spoken around the world, there are hundreds of different computer languages which create different types of code. Software engineers learn these languages and use them to create computer code.
It's hard enough learning one language. Do you have to learn all the languages?
I'm sure there's some very smart computer programmers who do know a large number of computer languages, but often software engineers will specialise in just one. It might depend on the type of programs they're writing. If you want to write programs for the internet, or for apps like the one you're playing, then you'll need to learn Java, JavaScript, and perhaps PHP. These are the languages behind the video games you play on your console too. If the programs you write are going to carry out complicated calculations, and if you want to be able to sort out and analyze data, then SQL is the language you need. A very popular language is called C. It's used in lots of ways, often in the background where it can talk to hardware. It might be giving the instructions to a hydraulic robot on a car production line, or running the program that makes your telly or radio work. As there are loads of applications and languages, software engineers will study a range before choosing an area in which to specialise.
I definitely choose video game programming.
No surprises there. It's a very exciting time to be a software engineer. They're working with cool new technology to shape our homes and lives in many new ways.
Alexa, set an alarm for 7 a.m.
Computer code is used to connect apps and smart gadgets. A control app can connect with a clock app to set an alarm, or connect to a music app to play your favourite tune. It can even connect to smart light bulbs and switches in your house to turn appliances on and off when you're not there.
Cool! I wonder if it could tidy up my bedroom or finish my homework for me.
Well, in the future it might be possible, but it'd be a lot quicker if you just get on with it and do it yourself.
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/technomum.
Loads of chances for you to listen to brand new episodes of Techno Mum. You can download them for free on the Fun Kids app for your phone and tablet, and they're always there for you to check out over at funkidslive.com. Now, a few weeks ago on the show, we spoke a new news story all about sharks. Do you remember this? It was all about how the planet is getting hotter, and because of this, the oceans around the UK, they're getting warmer, which is attracting a load more exotic species of sharks than we've ever seen before, which is amazing to think that we could have things that were once living in Australia around the shores of Cornwall. The thing is, though, it's not all good news. And there's things that we need to do to help the sharks out. So we'll talk to an animal expert about this in just a sec. First, I want to say a quick hello to Ashton, who is 10. Hey, Ashton. He says that he loves the show and that he finds it really amazing and interesting. Incredible stuff. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Ashton. If you want a shout out on this show, just like that, it's dead simple. All you need to do is to leave us a review on the iTunes podcast store. So get out your phone or your tablet open it up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly and leave us a review. Drop your name, 5 stars would be amazing. There's a little comment box and you can say hello to me and then I will read it and I will say hello to you. It really is that simple. Just find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. Now, a few weeks ago on the Fun Kids Science Weekly with Science in the News, we spoke about how different shark species from all over the world are starting to make the waters around the UK their home. And I thought this was way too important news to just let go. So on the phone is a marine scientist from the University of Southampton. They're the guys that discovered this, Dr. Ken Collins. Welcome along to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, to start, what were the signs that you initially picked up that showed that more sharks were visiting us?
Well, it wasn't really the sharks initially. It was fish. In the English Channel, in the time that I've been a marine scientist, it's actually warmed up by 1 degree centigrade, which doesn't sound a lot, but if you're a fish and live in the water, it is quite a lot. And we expect it the seas around Britain to keep warming up, and that will change what fish and other animals we have in our seas. There's a wonderful fish called the grey Atlantic triggerfish. It's about the size of an enormous dinner plate, and it's very, very sort of warm water looking. You know, it's very strange, and we used to have it just as a summer visitor. And then about 20 years ago, we noticed it was staying all year round because it had said, right, no, it's warm enough for us. We no need to migrate back down south. So that was one of the things.
So you've got these signs that they're changing, but then what do you do to actually find out what fish and what sharks may be there? Because, I mean, I know we're not the biggest country, but it's a lot of water. How do you go about studying this?
Right, well, we know, I mean, there are a lot of enthusiastic fishermen around. I mean, it's one of the most popular hobbies in this country. And there are a number of fishermen who really love fishing for sharks. And, yeah, you know, but they are still conservation-minded and they don't kill them. They like the fight they get, and then they handle them carefully, and some of them have worked with me to put little number tags in them so that if someone catches that shark again, and we can work out what's been going on. And we found that they travel all around the UK, right out into the middle of the Atlantic, even down to the equator. So, you know, we've learnt a lot with sports fishermen, and so we know that there are about 40 different types of sharks in our waters, and as the climate changes, the seas warm up, maybe get another 10 or even 20 more different types of sharks.
And it's completely diverse life, isn't it? Can you tell us a bit more about some of the sharks? I'm talking the giant hammerhead that we might see, the black tip shark, the bronze whaler. Can you just let us know more?
Yeah, let's start with just the biggest shark we have and is likely to get is still the very harmless basking shark, because that's all about 20 feet long, you know, 7 metres, maybe 8 metres long, and it swims very slowly. It's got enormous big fin, and it swims with its mouth open, and it doesn't have any teeth. It just filters plankton out of the water. And so it's totally harmless, and it's the most likely shark people are going to see. So, and then there are other, for the most part, the sharks are out at sea, often in deep water, so we don't notice them. And perhaps, you know, near the coast, there might be small dogfish and cat sharks, which are only a few feet long. I mean, as long as your arm, if that. So fairly small and insignificant. So most people don't get excited about them. But yes, we might get new species of sharks coming in. And you mentioned the great hammerhead, but we actually already have hammerhead sharks, a different type, around the UK anyway. So what's coming in isn't hugely different from what we've got.
Now, long term, well, right now, the sharks and all the diverse fish, they're coming here because we're getting hotter. We've just established that. Long term, say 20, 30 years in the future, if the seas continue to get hotter, what do you guys think might happen then?
Well, yes, we'll have more types of sharks, and so on. But my big worry is that around the world, we are killing sharks faster than they can produce young. So, and year on year, we're getting less and less sharks, and people particularly catch them to make shark fin soup. They just catch them to chop off their fins and send them to Southeast Asia and China. So that's very sad. And, oh, they get caught accidentally. Some people like to eat shark meat. And the other problem that's affecting all marine creatures is pollution. And I'm sure everybody has watched Blue Planet by now and aware of the problems with plastics in the sea. And apart from they're unsightly, they absorb our chemical pollutants, and then that will affect everything in the sea. And because sharks are at the top of the food chain, they are, you know, very much affected by everything they eat. And so we are losing sharks very fast. So whilst I'm, you know, saying, well, you know, 20, 30 years' time, there may be more sharks. Well, some of them are endangered now. And, you know, I mean, endangered means we're going to lose them completely. They go extinct, you know, if we don't do something to protect them.
What do you think we should do?
Well, that's a very simple thing. Think about plastic. We're trying to cut down on you know, throwaway plastic bottles, all sorts of things. A simple thing is plastic straws. So think about anything plastic you're using and try and cut down and dispose of it in a sensible way, rather than, it's so sad to walk around and see our streets and parks with plastic rubbish and, you know, walking along the beach. So that's one thing. The other thing is, when you go for a Chinese meal, don't have shark fin soup.
Ken, lastly, with the introduction of more sharks into the sea, What does that mean for the rest of the wildlife? What can we expect? Can we expect some fish to leave in the next few years because they don't want to be eaten? What's going to happen to the other creatures?
I mean, remember, I predict there are going to be less sharks around us. So the sharks coming in are really no different to what we've got already. On the whole, we will not actually notice it. But remember, sharks are there for a reason. Nature needs the lions and the tigers and the wolves, like we have on land, to control the weaker species and keep the seas and the land healthy. So they're there for a reason. Just because we don't like things with big teeth, you know, don't despise them. And then no need to be frightened of them. You know, most sharks will run away from you rather than, very few actually want to eat you. They're much more tasty things in the sea than humans.
I don't know if that's an insult or not. Anyway, Dr. Ken Collins, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
You're hugely welcome.
Time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most mean and evil things in the world. Today, it's a strange one, because on the face of it, it's something that should be good, should make you feel really healthy, but instead, it can make you deadly ill. The ackee is a fruit. It's a bit like a lychee. It's found in West Africa and in the Caribbean. It's pear-shaped, bright red and orange, and when it is ripe, it splits open and a thick, black, round, kind of grapey thing falls out of the middle and you can eat it, but you need to wait until it's ripe. That's why I repeated it. Because you also need to take the bad things out as well, because the seeds, they contain a poison called hyperglycin. Now, hyperglycin can cause the Jamaican vomiting sickness, where you get stomach aches. You start throwing up everywhere, hence the name. You get dehydrated, it can cause seizures, can put you in a coma, can even make you end up dead. Who knew, right? Fruit, it can make you die. So make sure, I guess, that the ackee is not one of your five a day, because it could very well be the last day that you ever have. Hello, by the way, if you are listening to this in Hungary, because the Fun Kids Science Weekly is the ninth biggest podcast in Hungary. I read that stat and it got me thinking just how mad it is, right? Think about it. You know, some science that I am chatting about in a studio, it gets recorded and it gets listened to all over the world. And I wanted to know how that happens, why it works. So we're finding out with an episode from The Speakers.
The Speakers. the speakers, transmission, satellites and cables.
Did you know masts and towers aren't the only way to carry TV and radio signals around? The speakers are checking out some other ways, and one is out of this world.
It's pretty amazing that radio waves managed to get from the transmitter to our radios and TVs at all. There are so many things to get in the way, however high up the transmitters are. Imagine if there were no buildings, no hills, and no trees. The signal would carry on forever.
No buildings, hills, or trees. Sounds a bit boring.
And it wouldn't carry on forever anyway.
How come?
Because the Earth is round, which means it curves. Very high-frequency radio waves travel in straight lines. So at some point, they would just disappear into space.
I thought the Earth was flat.
Really?
Nah, only kidding.
There are a couple of ways to get around the problem, though. One is using something flying above our heads right now.
Easy horse flights.
Higher than that, satellites. Communication signals of all sorts can be beamed to satellites thousands of miles above the Earth. The satellites send the signals back down to anyone who has a dish. It gets around the problem of stuff getting in the way, because, well, look in the air. It's pretty empty.
So the dishes we have on our houses, they're catching the signals as they're sent down, right?
Correctamundo.
But the Earth is spinning all the time. What if it's spun round the other side of the Earth when I want to watch Britain's Cake Factor?
Now, Britain's Cake Factor.
The satellite moves in orbit at the same rotation as the Earth, which means it always appears at the same spot in the sky. It moves so your satellite dish doesn't have to.
Oh, what about the International Space Station? Is that a satellite too?
Well, yeah, but they've got a lot of important experiments to do, not sending you episodes of Britain's Cake Factor. Communication satellites don't have any astronauts on board. They're basically computers. Some as small as a lunchbox and some as big as a house. There's another way to get signals around, which is a lot more down to earth. Under the earth, in fact. Under our roads and streets are loads of cables. Some carry electricity. But others are fibre optic cables, which are designed to carry information. And that includes TV and radio signals.
Oh, hang on. That's cable TV, right?
Well, duh.
Yeah, but it's not just TV. It can be radio, telephone calls, and internet data too. It's how a lot of houses connect to the internet.
I love it already. Time for another quick post on my chat room.
So, in the same way that a radio with an antenna grabs the waves out of the air and sorts them into different stations, the cable TV box gets a load of digital data and sorts that out.
Yep, and because you can send so many copies of each piece of data, digital signals are harder to interrupt. Clever, huh?
Reminds me of a joke. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
The interrupting cow.
The speaker's transmission with support from Arqiva. Find out more at funkidslive.com/speakers.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. NASA has named the astronauts who will fly the first missions to space in commercial rockets. Now, these are companies that people can pay money to fly up into the galaxy with. One of these astro pilots is called Chris Ferguson, and he will fly on its maiden voyage next year. Also, one of Britain's most elusive birds is back breeding at a special reserve for the first time in 45 years. A pair of nightjars have nested in the RSPB charity HQ in Bedfordshire. They were spotted by a bird watcher who heard their distinctive chirring call. And finally, research has shown that hothouse Earth could soon be a real thing. It sounds like something from a science sci-fi horror movie, doesn't it? But studies have shown that if the global temperatures continue to rise, if they go up by another 2 degrees, we could be on an irreversible pathway, that's what the scientists say, where the world will trap so much heat that the whole planet could boil. Still, happy summer! It's time for a quick trip through the galaxy to get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system and hear from Professor Pulsar and the guys from Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
This term's assignment is to write your very own universe handbook. You want to cram it full of all the basic things you need to know about space exploration. Yeah, the nuts and bolts of it all. So, let's crack on. Talking of nuts and bolts, Electra, do you think this term you might just remember to tighten your screws to stop various robot limbs from impeding my progress across the room?
Sorry, sir.
Let's start at the beginning. What's the first thing you need to do when you're planning a journey into space?
Make sure you've inflated your lunar lilo.
I thought the holiday might have calmed you lot down. Fat chance. The first thing you need to do is work out where you're going. Have a good look at what's out there. So, how do we observe space?
We use a telescope.
Telescopes aren't the only way to observe space, you know, Alex.
Telescopes are, however, a great place to start. Much better than just using our eyes. Sorry, I'd forgotten you've only got the one blurb. Very nice it is too. So, telescopes, how do they work?
The standard optical telescope works by reflecting or refracting large quantities of light from the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum to a focal point observable through an eyepiece.
Or basically, it scoops up a load of light and squeezes it down to a small point on your eye, where the image appears a lot bigger than it started.
That's what I said!
You're both right. But optical telescopes only work for the visible universe. Stuff our eyes, or eye, sorry blurp, can see.
Well, that's when you need a radio telescope, or an infrared telescope, or even an X-ray telescope.
Cool. Are they like X-ray specs? Can they see through walls?
Behave, Alex. Stats is right. Those sorts of telescopes can pick up waves our eyes can't see to give us even more information about the universe, including images. And infrared telescopes are particularly handy because they also give us information about the temperature of a planet. Have a look at this projection of an infrared image. You'd be right. This planet has been covered in ice for billions of years. What about this one?
Well, it's red and orange in swirls. Is it a hot planet?
You're right. The red-coloured images show us that the temperatures on this planet are much higher.
Much more my style. Get the sunglasses on, crack open the sun cream.
And then you'd burst into flames on this particular planet. Still a bit hotter than you're used to, Alex. A toasty 3,000 degrees. So telescopes can tell us what's out there and how hot or cold they are. But if we're going to visit, we'll need to know how far we have to go. How do we measure distance in space?
Sat-nav?
It'd have to be a blooming big one. No, there are many ways to measure distance in space, but the most common method is called parallax.
Parallax? Isn't that the horrible galactic lurgy that everyone in school got last year?
No, Stats, although it does sound a bit like a nasty disease. Parallax is better shown than explained. If you hold your thumb in front of your face and look at it first with your right and then with your left eye, can you tell me what happens?
Weird. It looks like my thumb moves.
Bingo. It seems to move in relation to the background. How much it moves depends on how far away from your face it is. The distance to a star or planet can be measured by tracking its movement relative to other stars or planets further away. You have to take measurements from two places in our orbit to work it out. And the distance is given in light years.
If it's a distance, why is it measured in years? Shouldn't it be miles? And what's light got to do with it anyway?
The light year is used in astronomy because the universe is huge. The nearest star to your solar system, Alex, is Alpha Centauri, 24 trillion miles. And because the numbers are so big, scientists came up with a simpler unit. A light year is the distance that light travels in space in 1 year. It's around 6 trillion miles, give or take a bit. So Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. Much simpler. That's the bell. Next time, we'll be having a think about how we prepare ourselves for deep space exploration.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
And a lesson from the guys at Deep Space High is where we finish a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, if you want a shout out next week on the show, it is dead simple. You just need to open up the iTunes podcast chart and leave the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review. Make sure you leave your name as well so I know who you are. I will see that and I should say hello in the next few weeks. Also, while you're on iTunes, remember, it's the best place that you can listen, really, to all of the epic Fun Kids Science series that we've got. They're on there. They're also on the free Fun Kids app where you can download it to your phone and tablet, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. And you can hear Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. Bye!
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.